Brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT.
Welcome to the On SOA podcast series brought to you by Pearson Education. We're continuing our discussion of SOA and service orientation with best-selling SOA author Thomas Earle, who's just in the process of completing his fourth SOA book titled SOA Design Patterns. Thomas, we always introduce you as the series editor of the Prentice Hall Service Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle, but you're also the editor of the SOA magazine. Can you talk about that in a couple words?
Oh, sure. It's an online publication we have. It's been out there now for well over a year. It's on a monthly basis. We publish a handful of articles that explore different aspects of service-oriented computing. We have contributors from all around the world providing either case studies or documenting new technologies or new ideas. It's just intended as a supplement for the book series in general, but also it is in its own right a mainstream publication that would be useful to anyone, and it's certainly worth checking out. It's absolutely free, and all the back issues are kept on the site for open access. So it's something that I think I've seen both practitioners and vendors as well as people in the academic community take advantage of.
Excellent. So editor of a book series and a magazine, and you have a day job, so I take it you don't have all that much free time.
Well, actually, Heather, there's one more thing I quickly wanted to mention.
Yeah.
We just recently started up a new interview series called SOA Pioneers. We interview practitioners who've been through SOA projects and want to share their experiences. It's not as much about case studies as it is about just different people who've been in the field providing their insights, and I'd like to encourage any of the listeners who know of somebody or themselves might be interested in participating to contact me directly.
Great, and where would they find that contact information?
They can go to thomaserle.com and they can contact me through that site.
Sounds like a great opportunity. Okay, so getting back to the topic at hand. In our previous discussion, we are focusing on high-level, big-picture stuff, the SOA vision, advantages, strategic perspectives, and so on. Today, we're going to get into the actual design approach for making all this happen. Now, in your recent book, which I believe published this past summer, SOA Principles of Service Design, you document this approach by describing a series of design principles. Can you step us through those principles and explain why each is important?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very much worth understanding these. Even if you're not into design yourself, if you're a developer or an analyst or even a project manager, I think it's very important that you at least have a high-level understanding of what service orientation as a design paradigm is all about, the implications of applying it, because if you are on an SOA project team, service orientation will affect you in some way. And just to have everyone on the same page, I think just having this type of overview is very helpful. What I would suggest is that you go to soaprinciples.com, and actually I'm going to go there now as well,
okay,
and have a look at that site. It provides an overview of the individual patterns, and I'll actually ask you to click the links as I talk about them. If you want to start with the section where it says Service Orientation Design Principles, and the first link says Standardized Service Contract, which is the first design principle we'll discuss.
Got it.
Super. So here you'll see a diagram, and in this case we're showing the service contract description documents that would be part of a service if it were to be implemented as a web service. And here we have a WSDL, a policy definition, and a schema. And what this design principle essentially advocates is that we carry out the design of services in a contract-first manner. So contract-first design is not something new with SOA or service orientation. It's been a best practice in circles for quite some time, but it becomes much more prominent. It becomes an actual requirement in the SOA world. We have to deliver, we have to customize and design service contracts as per predefined service design standards to ensure that the endpoints we establish express their capabilities consistently, but more importantly, share the same data models, share the same structures as much as possible, and that all ties into the key goals of service-oriented computing, which is to establish intrinsic interoperability between services. So the ability for services to be naturally compatible and exchange data without the need for transformation technologies. And so that's something we accomplish if we carry out this principle to a larger extent. So here, it's hard to make out on the website, but you can see the different areas, just as an example, of these types of web service contract documents that would be affected by standards. It affects all parts, especially for schema, where we want to, if we have two different services that deal with invoice data, we would want them to be based on the same invoice data model so that we avoid the need for runtime data transformation. And again, that's something where when we deliver the services, we ensure that they share the same schema to represent that data, or if we allow schemas to be different, we ensure that they are still aligned. And again, that just makes the services naturally compatible. And this then, of course, is a principle we apply regardless of who delivers services or when they are delivered. If we have different project teams building different services for different purposes, all the services conform to the same design standards as per this principle. And therefore, in the future, when we need to take different services from what those individual project teams delivered, put them into some new composition, they are again naturally compatible from an endpoint basis. So that's the key requirement here. And this design principle affects other principles and forms the basis of formal service-oriented design processes. And if you want to learn more about processes for service design or for service modeling which precedes service design, I would check out soamethodology.com, which provides some concise information for that.
Okay.
So this is a very fundamental principle, and it basically says the requirement is that we deliver the contracts first and that they all comply to design standards. And again, the standards would be specific to an inventory boundary. So we talked about inventories during our past podcast in the series, and the service inventory establishes the physical boundary. If you have multiple domain inventories, they are individually standardized and governed. And usually when we then talk about standardization, it is only within the scope of one of those inventories. We're not saying, and that we have to be really clear about this, with this design principle specifically, we are not saying that in order to design services, you need to have a global data model that is standardized across the entire enterprise. That is not a requirement. If you choose a domain inventory-based approach, you standardize within those domains. They still represent meaningful segments of the enterprise, but everything becomes more manageable, and you accept the fact that you will have some transformation requirements between the inventories, but you still work towards very much a federated endpoint layer.
Okay.
And I'll just quickly say one more thing about this. The reason that the design standards for service contracts are so important is because one of the main things we look to accomplish, or one of the things we always keep in mind when applying service orientation, is something we call transformation avoidance. Even though there are very mature and reliable technologies out there that can transform, that can overcome disparity between contracts, can transform, for example, one data model into another data model, or in the case of a web service, one XML schema format into another, those exist and we can use them and they have been successfully used. Our goal is, in fact, to avoid them as much as possible, because even though they are solid technology, they introduce additional development effort, because we have to build this transformation logic, this mapping logic from one data model to another. It introduces design complexity, because we have to now have these different transformation layers between each communication of two services that need to exchange data. And they introduce performance overhead, because the transformation logic is executed every single time two services with different data models need to communicate at runtime. So every time two services exchange data, this transformation layer needs to be invoked and carry out the transformation from one to the other. And all that can really start to bog down a collection of services. And if you think of a larger service composition where you might have 6 or 8 or 10 services all working together in concert to support one business task which has to execute at runtime within milliseconds, and if those services were not designed as per this principle and were not intrinsically interoperable as a result, you would have all these different transformation layers in between the service communication channels, and it would truly compromise the effectiveness of that composition. So we don't want to ever be at that point, and we look to prevent that requirement of having to use transformation technologies with this principle. So, okay, let's move on to the next one here, which is service coupling, service loose coupling. So you'll see on this diagram, if you click the services coupling link on the left pane there, you'll see how service decoupling is not something that is just about maintaining independence. It's a multifaceted design consideration that really should be understood by everyone, especially those who design the services. Coupling itself, I mean, the term loose coupling has also become somewhat of a buzzword and gets used and abused in different areas, and it's good to have a real grasp as to what it means and what its implications are to service design. So let's try to quickly cover that, but it's a large topic that probably you'd be better off reading about more in depth. This is important to you.
Okay.
So, yeah, so just in a nutshell, the term coupling represents a connection between two things. That's basically what it means. If two things are connected, they're coupled. If two things are not connected, they're decoupled. And what we're interested in, because we do have to connect services for them to work together, we're interested in the extent of coupling that they require. So if we think of coupling in different levels as pertaining to different levels of dependencies that those who want to use a service can form on the service itself, then we can get into making a distinction between more tightly coupled connections and more loosely coupled connections. The more dependencies that we require a program to form on a service, the more tightly coupled that program becomes to the service as a whole. And so we want to loosen the coupling, not just between the consumer and the service, but also between parts of the service architecture itself, which in turn then has implications as to the extent of coupling that consumers will be required to comply to. I know that's a bit circular, but let's look at this diagram here. It'll help clarify that. What we're focused on primarily here, again, is the service contract, how we position that within an overall service architecture. If you look at the service contract there in the, toward the top, how we position that service contract will depend on how it relates to other parts of the service environment. So you can see below it, there's the service logic that are part of its implementation, maybe a database that it has to access. To the right there is vendor technology that we use to build the service. To the left on the top are business processes that the service may be linked to in some way. And then, of course, other services that the service itself may need to compose. When we establish the service contract, we can make a choice. We can auto-generate the contract using development tools, which commonly support this, and then the contract itself becomes derived from its underlying implementation. And physical design characteristics such as database tables and underlying component APIs become embedded in the service contract. At that point, the service contract itself is considered implementation coupled. It has a contract to implementation coupling that ties it to that underlying implementation. And then any consumers that bind to the service inherit that coupling. They get something we call indirect implementation coupling because that coupling is now imposed upon them. And then if we change the underlying logic, it becomes a lot more difficult to avoid impacting consumers because the contract itself is coupled to the implementation. Technology coupling is something we relate to vendor technology, so that pertains to the part of the diagram on the right there. Not all services need to be web services. We can have services that exist as .NET or Java components. And in that case, the contract that they expose is proprietary or is specific, I should say, to that platform. So it then requires that all consumers be able to support that platform. So if we have a .NET component, consumers have to work with .NET or use some sort of bridging technology to interact with the .NET API standards. And then if we ever choose to change that technology, it'll impact the consumers again because they are coupled to the technology. The contract is coupled to the underlying technology, and the consumers also become coupled to that technology.
Okay.
So, and just quickly, the other types of coupling pertain to those parts on the left. There's something we call functional coupling, which has to do with dependencies on the actual logic that the service is there to support. And there's other types of coupling that we can get into, but the point is the more coupled the contract is to those underlying environments, the more risk there is that it will impose those types of couplings to the consumers. And what that does is it limits our ability to evolve the service over time without compromising the dependencies that the consumer programs form on the service. So the key thing here is to avoid any type of coupling between the contract, from the contract to any part of its underlying environment. So contract to logic coupling, contract to technology coupling, contract to implementation coupling, contract to functional coupling, those are all types of coupling that we categorize. They're all considered negative types of coupling because the contract is in some way expressing or dependent on parts of its underlying implementation, and when those underlying things change in the future, it can impact those that use the contract on the outside.
Okay.
The type of coupling we advocate is what we call logic to contract coupling. So when the underlying parts of a service support the contract, but the contract itself does not tie or depend on any part of the underlying environment, then you establish this freedom. The contract itself becomes decoupled from its underlying implementation and other factors that form the service. And that is accomplished by, again, performing a contract-first design approach where you start with the contract, you standardize it independently, you make sure it conforms to various types of conventions that all the other services within an inventory conform to, and then you produce that contract to the development team, and they build the underlying logic and implementation in support of that contract. And that way, the contract always remains independent from the underlying environment, and you can evolve that environment without impacting the contract, and then without carrying forward that impact to the service consumers. So that's the big thing about serviceless coupling and the implications thereof. There are many different aspects that we haven't covered, but again, fundamentally, it's important to understand that loose coupling has to do with dependency, and we look to minimize dependencies on the service consumers as much as possible.
Excellent.
So, okay, I know we're running a bit long here, but I'll try to cover these others a bit quicker. The next one on the list is service abstractions. If you'd like to click that link
okay. There
on the side, you'll see a diagram where you have different types of services encapsulate different types of environments or systems or different types of logic, each with their own characteristics. And the important perspective here is the top layer there. You have those federated services that are standardized, and the underlying environments are disparate. So you have that separation. And what this principle then advocates is that you don't even make the outside world aware of what lies beneath a particular service endpoint, a particular service contract. You actually intentionally keep that hidden. And you essentially turn services into black boxes. The idea being that the more you contain that information, the greater freedom you have to evolve it. If I, as a service consumer program developer, know that a service is encapsulating a particular type of environment using a particular type of technology, I can still tune my consumer program to take advantage of that, to be different in response to that knowledge so that I can better optimize my system that will use the service. But if in the future that service technology changes and actually you replace it or you extend it and you actually modify it in such a manner that it is different, you maintain the service contract and you maintain the behavior you promised through that contract, but the underlying technology is different, that will still impact me as a service consumer developer because my system was tuned to that particular underlying environment.
Okay.
And you look to avoid impact on consumers as much as you can while giving you the freedom to evolve your service implementation as much as you can. And so that's why this has to do with information hiding, having processes in place that manage that. It also has to do with optimizing or minimizing the amount of logic you actually express about a service, which might require streamlining the service contract to a certain extent so that you don't put too many dependencies in it, and then some of those dependencies or requirements that you put in the contract, if they're subject to change, then again, that will impact the service consumer. So we're primarily concerned with extending the lifespan, the longevity of service contracts as much as possible to avoid getting into versioning, which in itself introduces governance burden, And by optimizing the service contract and by hiding information as to what's below it, we give ourselves the best chance of accomplishing that. I'll just quickly mention, in terms of optimizing the service contract, the common things that can impact it is if we have validation rules that that are in some way connected to business rules or underlying business processes, and those things change, then that impacts the service contract. It impacts those constraints, and when we have to change those, we may be forced to get into different service versioning situations, and that's what we look to avoid as much as possible with this principle.
Great.
So let's talk about service reusability. The diagram here actually nicely illustrates this. When you think of how service reusability is approached differently than with past design processes or design approaches, we actually look at how we build logic for a traditional enterprise, and we know our environment, but we also incorporate techniques from the commercial product world as well. If you think about it, reuse is something that has been a natural part of IT for as long as it has existed. Any off-the-shelf product, software product that's been built has been built for reuse. It's been built for a mass market that will use it for different purposes. It does something meaningful, but it is sufficiently generic so that we can put it out there on the shelf and have different people buy it for their different environments and use it for their own purposes. So reuse is a natural part of IT. It's not something new and mysterious. It's something that has just been part of a different sector of IT, the commercial product industry, versus the sector of IT which focuses on custom applications for specific enterprises. So we merge those two approaches. We borrow techniques from commercial product design together with considerations that come from designing software for traditional enterprises into an approach where we focus on this design principle, which applies specific characteristics that make the service as reusable as possible. And I won't get into all those right now, but just that overall comprehension is important, how these two things are now together. And we have agnostic and non-agnostic services. Those that are agnostic are very much subject to this design principle, and it has all kinds of implications and requirements as to how we can best deliver services that are truly reusable.
Thomas, thank you so much for walking us through those first four principles up through reusability. Hopefully all of our listeners found that to be very thorough and attractive. But we're actually out of time right now. I just wanted to mention, I noticed that the SOA Principles of Service Design book has a chapter that compares service-oriented design with object-oriented design. So I think that's going to make for an interesting future podcast topic, don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And I think what we'll do then is actually cover the remaining four principles in the next podcast. Would that be all right?
That sounds wonderful. We wouldn't want to leave those out. So thank you once again, Thomas, and for all of our listeners out there, you can learn more about the SOA Principles book by visiting soabooks.com. On that page, you can actually get free sample chapters, and you can download a free color poster, which you might find useful in your day-to-day work. The SOA Principles book was a third title in the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle, and his upcoming SOA Design Pattern, scheduled to publish in March of 2008, will be the fourth title in that series. And just so you know, there are five additional books that are underway for the series, and they will also begin to publish in 2008. And for all of you listeners, if you want to preview any of the SOA Design Patterns book and to sample some of those patterns, they're actually posted at soapatterns.org. So feel free to hop over there and check that out. Thomas, once again, thank you for being part of our podcast today. And to all of you listeners, we have several more on SOA podcasts heading your way soon, including one covering those remaining principles that Thomas just referenced. So please be sure not to miss that. Thanks to everyone. Take care.